right, now welcome to Pro 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 655. Jason Lingren is with me and Paul Yates returns. We're going to cover music in an interesting way. Paul has some direct knowledge. We'll share as we can. Of course, Jason has hovered around the music industry all of his life. And once upon a time, I was in a band having fallen into the social engineering that brought us punk rock. We've talked about these things. We've mentioned how the seminal album in punk named Nevermind was again repeated in the grunge era, refashioning, reshaping, deglamming, simplifying music, and the seminal album of that era also sharing the word Nevermind. There are other things we've talked about, like the band Damn Yankees can easily fill stadiums, can easily sell platinum albums, being paid something like $1 million to walk away and to stop doing it, to set the stage for the onset of hip hop and rap to dominate the world and lower minds in both frequency, lyric, and intent. With that, welcome, Jason.
And a warm good morning.
All right. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. It's great to be back. I love this show.
So I think we're going to jump in to kind of show that music has been deftly crunched into the dumpster here. I don't think it's any secret. We occasionally mention things like the last time there were key changes in popular music, early 90s, mid 90s. And that is a very basic part of music to include a key change in a song. But at this point, Paul, I would estimate that the majority of the so-called A-list music stars don't play instruments, don't read music, and many of their songs don't even have harmony or melody for that matter.
Yeah, the same with the Great Brain Robbery book, where I've tracked all the sort of devolution of society. I've actually lived it in the music business. And, you know, complex arrangements, complex writing, complex chord progressions, they've been ditched. And we're now at a point with music. I mean, I think rap started it all. But we're basically at a point now where music is just nursery rhymes to a really bad beat.
Nursery rhymes to an audience or to manufacturers of those rhymes that can't even read. But I would mention, when you look at the scape of music from like the 70s forward, somewhere in there, we got to a point where repetition was just beat into us. It was expected when you turned on a new song that you were going to hear a chorus, a bridge, you know, an intro over and over and over. It gets to the point where I can cite examples like maybe Warren Zevon's Werewolf of London, where there is no chorus, there's no bridge. It is literally the same chord progression all the way through the music.
Yeah, I mean, you only have to look at, do you know Max Martin? Have you heard of that guy?
Not sure. Who is he?
Songwriter.
He's the guy that's, well, I mean, he's pretty much under the radar, but he's responsible for probably for the last 20 years for at least four of the top 10 on Max Martin songs.
Oh, is that's the guy that they kind of allude to in the movie Silver Lake, the music maker?
Probably. He's written for everybody. Britney Spears, just everybody. And there's a fair chance that whatever you're listening to on commercial radio, within 10 minutes, you'll be listening to a Max Martin song. And he sort of, he jumped on the formulaic method of writing. And it's actually documented now that if you don't hit the chorus in the first 10, 20 seconds, then you're not going to have a hit with it. And it's got to that level now. It's almost cut and paste. That's how you write now if you want to be successful. And when you're listening to it, I can only listen to commercial radio for probably 10 minutes maximum because it's just the same song with the same format, just in a different key and a different singer. It's just insane the way it's gone at the moment.
Well, I noticed a thing not too long ago. My car came with Sirius radio for, I don't know, a year and a half or something like that. And what I noticed is when I went to see what was there, you know, there's hundreds of channels, everything you can imagine. So I loaded up some of the old 60s, 70s, 80s stuff. But over that time, that 1 year roughly, the amount of music from the rock era they were playing diminished and diminished and diminished to the point where they started sliding hip hop in on the 90s, which doesn't seem too strange. But then on the 80s channel, they began to slip in hip hop. And it seemed to me that they were trying to draw back the founding of hip hop to an earlier date than it actually happened.
Yeah. I mean, I like hip hop, but I don't like the violent hip hop. And it's, I mean, they've got great rhythms, but they don't do anything with it. They just, I don't know, I'm probably the wrong guy to talk to regarding that form of music. But I mean, some of it's good. Some of it's really good.
The problem that you notice is that one beat that reoccurs, you know, it just, so many songs end up with that same structured beat. And part of the problem is, I mean, some of it, I don't even think it should be called music. It should be called poetry to a beat or something. There's no melody. There's no harmony. There's no played instruments per se. Set that aside. What's being delivered in the lyrical content is simply mind-lowering. I can't recall off the top of my head music of this kind or so-called music of this kind with interesting lyrics.
Well, yeah, I mean, but if they did, would there be an audience for it these days? I mean, it's a fairly glib thing to say that, but most people that I see of sort of, I don't know, 17 to 20 plus, would they get it now?
I see a lot of reaction channels when I care to look, and so many young people are going back to the 70s bands, to the 80s bands, and appreciating it in a new way. But exactly what you're saying, they seem astonished a lot of times, and you think, how could they have lived, you know, their young life without having heard this music? Some of it they have, but they dig in, and then like Crazy Train or something will make its rounds through these circles, and it's new to them. And that's where, you know, when I was young, every month there was new music coming out, and so much of it became iconic. It was to a point where you figured this is never going to go away. But in fact, it did. And Jason and I have talked about it. Jason puts it right where I do. By about 95, the brakes had been put on and the transfer was in full swing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I see a lot of interviews with, dare I call them the brain donors. Oasis do a lot of interviews and they say the reason that they were so successful is there were no rock and roll guitar bands around anymore when they were discovered, in inverted commas. And forever, I've always sort of maintained the position, excuse me, that's when we were active and that's when all the other bands that we knew were active. And there very definitely was rock and roll guitar bands. So, I mean, it sounds like a paid opinion to me.
Isn't a more honest way to state what he just said is that the record companies got the memo and they were no longer going to put money behind guitar-driven music acts?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
There were plenty of guitar bands like in the early 90s, but I think by the time you're getting into around 2000, oof.
But they were all there, and they're still all there. But nobody's taking a chance on these guys because that's not what the industry's looking for at this particular period.
Oh, God, no. Especially these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so obvious now. I know guys in bands that were just mind-bendingly good, and they were signed purely to be shelved. Do you know what shelving is?
Yes. Put away.
Yeah, put away so that they don't compete with the guys that the label's already signed that they've thrown a lot of money at. So, right, we need to get these guys out of the equation because they're a threat to our success with this. So a lot of bands that I know were signed to be shelved, which how'd you get out of that?
I can't really be polite about this. To me, this is social engineering directed somewhere above even the record labels. And what's hard for, I think, the average person to think about it is you consider, like, to use the damn Yankees, which we've beat like a dead horse, the record company, wouldn't they be saying, let's take this moneymaker, put them out, and make money? And in fact, the opposite has happened. We're going to spend $1 million to ensure they don't.
Yeah.
To me, that's a directive from on high that overrides the probable intent of a company like that to want to try to make money. How do they get to buy in? How are they controlled? But some way they are controlled. And I think it's plain on the face of it that the intent here is to lower human consciousness through the music industry.
Absolutely. This all started, a lot of people will say, well, it came from the Nazis prior to World War II. There's a reference to it in the book, actually. I've gone into some depth about it. But they changed the tuning reference from 432 hertz to 440 hertz. They standardized it. And then a few years later, Britain followed, and then a few years after that, America followed. So everything was calibrated to 440, including the equipment that was recording them. And when you get into the frequencies and you look at what those two particular frequencies do, 432 hits you in the heart, which is why people used to break down uncontrollably during the classical renditions, your Mozarts and all that stuff. And they moved it to 440, which is, it's the head. It targets the head. So you can get the best orchestras in the world playing the classics, but if they're tuned to 440, it doesn't have anywhere near the same impact that it did 200 or 300 years ago. So it goes a long way back. This is quite a long agenda. And I think it can't get any worse, can it?
Well, this is the insidious nature, because people argued about this forever. Jason and I did a number of shows just saying, you know, wake up. It's a change. It's a demonstrable change. But Jason has a good ear. He's probably got a better ear than I do. Jason, if I played some song that you were familiar with in its original 440 tuning and then played a version in 432, do you think you could easily tell the difference?
Back to back for sure. Off the cuff, yes. Probably not, but I might. I've definitely picked up on things.
Kind of like the Robert Johnson thing, and we were saying something didn't sound right. There's the theory that the major releases of his are actually sped up. And when slowed down by a certain amount, it sounds a lot more natural, a lot more like what I would think he would sound like.
Well, you played that for me, and my gut instinct instantly said, that sounds correct once you pulled it back down a little bit. But to address, I did a lot of research on this because, as you remember, Jason, the first time I brought up the 432, 440, music teachers, PhDs, piano tuners all came into the comments telling me I didn't know my butt from a hole in the ground. One of the things I did is I demonstrated that there is a visual difference with a cymatic plate. I used the round example because it was the easiest to see the muddying. But I think it was 1936 when the people who lobbied to get the change for orchestral A tuning changed. It was fully adopted in 1955, the last time that I looked. But the genius behind it was there was a lot of pushback from a lot of places, particularly France. And by the way, there were a huge number of other tunings, but most of them would have been qualified as green tunings, I think. And you can tell by doing an addition, you know, a simple numerical adding down to a single digit to see where it lands. But to get to the point, once you get the orchestras of the world to tune their pianos to 440, everyone else is tuned into the piano because it's not easy to retune the piano. But it was done with intent. And the excuse put forward was acceptable to most people. But to this day, when we talk about this, I will get piano tuners and everyone else trying to tell me there's no difference and that what we're saying about it isn't true, when in fact there is 8 cycles a second difference, and the cymatic pattern that you can demonstrate shows the clarity of the older tuning get muddied once it's pushed up through 440.
Yeah, it's indisputable. You know, these guys that decry that is a thing need to listen to the two back to back. It's unmistakable. The clarity is just unparalleled. Everything has its own place and everything resonates in sympathy with everything else. There's no discord of, I mean, there's obviously discord when you play a chord progression or whatever, but that's intentional. But there's no dissonant frequencies happening. Whereas if you listen to sort of from Anthrax, Metallica onwards, there's huge dissonant frequencies happening. It's so obvious because there's guys that have done it on YouTube and they've actually rendered the old, when I say old, I say 80s, 90s stuff, and they've rendered it down to 432. And it's stunning. The absolute clarity and quality of it is just stunningly apparent.
It doesn't hit as hard or in the same way.
It hits you in a different place.
Yeah, the 440 definitely is good. If you're doing rock and metal especially, yeah, that 440 is good for really giving you that kick. 432 almost has a more relaxed sound to it, I would say.
It does. It really does.
It feels more open.
Yeah, that's the word. It's open. When you listen to acoustic music, it's just so rich when it, you know, including piano and things like that. But it's just got such a depth to it.
This is the whole idea of coming up in a world that knows nothing about alchemy, and the idea of it has been demonized, that it's evil somehow, which, to be fair, yeah, it can be. You get a bad person, they can use it in bad ways, but that's true of anything in this world. But the insidious nature of it for me is, like, if you played some old AC/DC tune, like Back in Black, and you played 1/4/3/2/4/40, I could probably pick up the difference. If I heard it alone, I would be guessing. And I know this because I tested myself. What's worse, if you get a less punchy song, because what I recognized, it was the power chords, the punch, that let me detect the more focused edge of 440. But if you get a more acoustic song, I mean, I'm guessing most of the time, I can't easily tell the difference. Maybe that's a thing you could train yourself. You probably could, but off the cuff, it could come right by me with me never knowing.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. We recorded, me and the singer, when we'd had the big fight with the label, we recorded an album, just the two of us, and between us, we played every instrument. And it was around the time when Pro Tools was launched. I think it was 2000, was it 2001, something like that. And we recorded an album of about 12, 13 tracks. And I recorded it in Cubase, which allows you to alter the tuning reference down to 432. And I switched over halfway through to Pro Tools when I got that. And I could not find the ability to do that. My computer was already running at 432, but Pro Tools brought it back to 440. And I couldn't really do much about that. But the difference was just, it was so stark. It was so bad, in fact, that I ditched Pro Tools and went back to the original Cubase because I could get it sounding right. But yeah, when you go to 440, it's great for driving music, for hard driving music, because it's got that brittle sound to it. It's crispy almost, whereas the 432, it's got rounded edges and it's fluffy and nice. And that's about the best way I can describe the two.
Well, when Pro Tools came along too, I still remember all the music industry people arguing, and some would argue what a boon it was, and others would say we're losing something here. But one of the things that marked the end of was live recordings, where there were open mics in a room and people recording. And what came along was, hey man, we don't need to do this anymore. We can cut this up in any which way we want. We can overdub, insert. And so these live organic tracks that were once a part of recording the music we listened to, that was diminishing rapidly with the onset of the ability to slice and dice anything.
What happened was we moved very quickly into a position of perfection, because that's what Pro Tools and now I use Logic now. It allows you to achieve as near as damn it perfection. Whereas if you've got four guys in a room all playing live, it's inevitable that you get the old bum notes and cock-ups and things like that. It's a good thing in that sense, but what it loses is the organic feel of a band that's cooking, because there's nothing like that that you can do with multi-track sequential recording. If you're laying down parts like a machine, then you're pretty tied on to have the result sounding like a machine. It's inescapable, really.
It loses its handmade charm. Jason, do you remember the talk with Jimmy Page, Eddie Van Halen? Do you remember that from way back?
I think so.
Eddie Van Halen, I don't remember, it was a guitar magazine or something, went on the record of basically saying Jimmy Page was sloppy.
Oh, yeah.
Totally agree.
But you see, the thing was, is that's why everybody loved it. It was that charming handmade quality. I can use the same song as another example. In Werewolf of London, which is the same chord progression all the way through, a false start is left into that song, if you're familiar with it.
I'm not, but that's good.
Well, it's clearly an error when you focus on it, but it's part of the charm of the song, because even if you don't recognize it as a false start, you remember that vocalization. And the only way I can describe it is the idea of handmade charm. And that's what gets removed. And that's what makes it, to me, authentic, or feel more authentic than precision.
Yeah.
Now, if anyone's not familiar that much with, like, the way things were done versus the Pro Tools digital era, it's not that you can't do things with Pro Tools. If you just treated it just like a tape machine, you could still do a whole band recording live. It's just that instead of going to a tape machine, a literal tape machine, you're just going to the Pro Tools machine. And that's fine if you like the sound of the analog to digital conversion that you're getting, because it's going to be a very, very clean thing. The thing about tape is different tape machines and different kinds of tape even all impart a different character. So at that point, it's a preference thing.
Good point, because the whole mic argument, you know, people were so big on those old mics. But I would ask the question, if we had had Pro Tools or something equivalent all the way back, would we ever get a song like, say, Levee Breaks by Zeppelin? That opening drum track where we're told it was done in this really deep hallway. Most people are familiar with the movie where Jimmy Page describes how it was mic'd. And I would suggest things like that, which are considered classic now, they might not even be if that analog era had been replaced with the precision that came later.
The cleverness they had to come up with back in the day, and the example I always like to give is Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles, which most people are familiar with, I think. That was released in 1967, and it was very, very groundbreaking for the time when people first heard it. They were bouncing between multiple four-track tape machines to get all of those layers on there. Now, these days, that's nothing, but back then when people first heard it, it blew their minds. And it even became kind of a competition at the time, especially between the Beatles and the Beach Boys, to see who could release the next mind-numbing record.
And what you're saying is exact. You know, I know you're more familiar than I am, Jason, but the whole argument of when tracks, how many tracks were available. The stories that I've heard, there was a famous pianist who did a movie that I saw. I don't remember his name, but he was on Endless Albums. And he claimed he went to Abbey Road and they didn't have as many tracks there as was emerging in America. But you're right. I was there in 77. When these albums came out, it was, you can't describe it. It's the first time you're ever hearing something like that. Suddenly it's on the radio. It's almost like pressing an instant classic in a way, if you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's horses for courses, really, because I mean, I often think, when we were in our heyday and I was churning songs out as fast as I could, if I'd have had Pro Tools back then, man, we'd have written some good shit. It just opens up the palette. It's like an artist getting a wall full of colour. It's just incredible. But the negative aspect of that is that you don't get that organic feel when you've assembled it. But we used to get around that because, I mean, we were still recording up to 2005. We used to get around that was I used to write using Cubase and I'd assemble the track and we'd change it all and alter the arrangements and move things around. And when we were happy with it, we'd then go and rehearse it like that and record it as live as we could do it. So at that point, we used the computer as a tape machine, like Jason said earlier. So we still tried to capture that organic feel, but you still get the cock-ups. It's unavoidable. But, you know, some people like that.
Well, you're making a critical point. So, Jason, you know it was 77 when Sgt. Pepper came out, and off the top of your head... 67. And you know that that was done with a four-track, right? There was nothing more at that time.
Right. Abbey Road was still on four tracks. That was the era where stuff was starting to really get pushed to the future with multiple tracks. They went from four tracks to eight tracks, but Abbey Road had more than one four-track machine. So what they were doing was they were doing what they generally call ping pong bouncing. You're getting a bunch of stuff on one machine and then bouncing that down to probably a single track on a separate machine, flying that back to the other one, freeing up tracks, and you do that back and forth.
Now, the big thing with tape is every time you do that, you get generational loss.
So it can add up and start sounding kind of...
It's degradation. It's basically analog degradation from the copy over.
Right. So you have to do it very selectively.
So you do a pile of vocals, for instance.
Queen was very well known for doing this, doing tons of vocals and then comping them all down.
Yeah.
And they did it enough that it definitely gave it a sound, but they didn't do it so much that it sounded awful as far as loss of quality. Nowadays, of course, if you want 16 vocal tracks, you just add 16 tracks and you sing them.
Yeah.
There's a key point to be made when this is going on. I don't remember the math, just so people listening, you have four tracks each track can hold content. When Jason said ping pong, you basically fill up three tracks and then you bounce it all down to one. I forget what the math is. You get 12 tracks or whatever. But Jason's pointing out they had 2 4 tracks, so it expanded that. But here's the point. From that point forward, you can't play that live anymore. There were 4 Beatles, and there are however many tracks. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, the first time Sgt. Pepper's was played live, I believe, was by Beatlemania, sometime way up into the 80s when synthesizers could do multiple things at once. So for the first time, they were recording mass consumption music that could no longer be played live.
Yeah, but that's understandable. We had raging arguments about this because we were predominantly a live band. And we had, towards the later stages, we had a nightmare recreating things live that we'd done in the studio with multitracking. And we sort of, my contention in all of that was, listen, one of them is a product and the other one is an experience. And you've got to draw the distinction between them. You create the product to be the best it can be. So if you use 200 tracks to make this absolute symphony of music, so be it. But you've got to then strip it back to be able to do it live and capture the essence of it, which is easy to do because most songs are written on a guitar or a piano anyway. So you can always bring it back. And it's the measure of a good song. If you can do it at that level, then it's a strong song. But just going back to the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's with the 4 tracks, I've had the distinct privilege of sitting in a guy's living room who owns the masters of Sgt. Pepper's, the 2-inch tapes.
Wow.
Yeah. And we just spent like a long afternoon just playing around with the mix and bringing things in and out. We had 8 tracks because of 2 machines. What a thing to be able to do. You know, I've actually done that.
What did you realize by having access to being able to hear those individual tracks and things? Did you realize things?
I think the biggest takeaway was the absolute level of genius of those engineers. Because don't forget, when you've bounced a track, let's say you've bounced 3 or 4 tracks down to 1 track, you've then lost the ability to manipulate those individual tracks once they're all on 1 track. So if you don't get that mix right before the bounce, you've lost it forever unless you go in and retrack it. Just the genius of that alone is just stunning to me.
So explain to people what that means. For people who know about images, this is what he just said. If you have a Photoshop document, you can have layers. So on the top layer, there's a head. On the next one down, there's a neck. And you have a whole body, each part on a layer. Each one of those body parts is editable. When you slap all the layers down to one image, like into a JPEG or something, you can no longer edit individual pieces. You can only affect the whole.
The analogy would be when you hit the flatten button in Photoshop. You've now
put
all that together as to one single thing. And by the way, if people might be confused because we didn't really touch on this, it's not that they only had 4 tracks to record to. Well, they did only have 4 tracks to record to. But say you're miking up a drum kit with a couple of mics. They had outboard mixers, so they might put kick, snare, overhead, or something like that. They might have 3 or 4 mics on the drum kit, but they're still only going to 1 track on the 4 track. So it's being mixed out, submixed is the proper term, down to mono. So there was a lot of that going on too.
Yeah, comping if you want to get really technical.
Consider too, you know, we know what the music industry and the film industry, how heavily it is used to create culture, to program society. Consider the mindset of recording an album with the biggest world band in the world, which the Beatles were at that time, and knowing that this isn't about them playing live. As a matter of fact, already knowing they're not going out to play this live. So from a social engineering standpoint, everything that goes into that studio, into that music, I mean, the intent must be vastly different than it had been before that.
Well, you've just nailed it. Where do you go with that? That's exactly what we hear when we listen to those albums. You know, they're pristine. They're absolutely pristine. And like I say, I've soloed these tracks individually on Sgt. Pepper's. And apart from things like hearing Ringo farting in the drum booth, the quality is just stunning. And that doesn't come from a band that was as busy as the Beatles, I'm afraid to say. And there's a lot more about that with Sage of Quay's material.
Everyone should go listen to Sage of Quay. In my mind, he is the authority on trying to demonstrate that the Beatles were in fact a Tavistock construct. The level of work he's done and the people he's interviewed, it's unparalleled. At least I'm unaware of anything that comes close. I don't know how you guys feel about it. So the other thing I wanted to mention is firsthand experience. When I got out of the Marine Corps in the very early 90s, I bounced at a couple jobs. I was actually a bouncer. That was a terrible job. And then I got, through a friend, into roadie work, being a local non-union stagehand. And as I've mentioned so many times, we did basically any and every show that came through Southern California. Even I went to other countries a couple times, other states. But early on, I would get excited because these big bands that I'd grown up with were coming to town and I was going to, you know, do the roadie work and see them play. I can't tell you the number of times that what I had heard on the album wasn't very well represented live. This happened a lot. But occasionally, a band would nail it. And you would think, wow, what's going on here? There's a definite difference. But the vast majority, there was a far cry from the music that I'd grown up with, the recorded music, to what was being offered live. And I'll say another thing, too. As the 90s went on, it seems like it got better, like the bands got better at delivering, which had to do with the tech and the audio and everything, I would guess. Do you have any inkling of what I'm laying down here, Paul?
100%. 100%. During our journey, we supported many, many, many bands that were either just breaking or had already just broken, and they were soaring and doing the bit. But we saw it so many times. We once played with a girl band, which on the face of it is a great idea because there's never been a girl band like the Bangles. I mean, they could do it, but they weren't quite as good as they were on the records, which kind of speaks to your point. But this girl band that we played with, they were utterly dreadful. And we could see they came out front to watch our set. And we didn't pull any punches when we were on stage. We sort of gave it people right between the eyes because that was our forte. And we actually talked about it afterwards, that we could see the fear in these girls' eyes. Because they had to go on after us. And when they went on, honestly, it was the biggest shambles you've ever seen, both seen and heard. And they were nothing like what they were on this brand new hotly tipped album. And it speaks to how much influence the producer has in all of this. Because it's the producer at the end of the day that makes the band sound. If the band aren't sort of characterful and have their own sound to bring into the studio, it's the producer that creates it. And we saw that so many times.
It was commonplace. And I got to the point where I was so jaded that I was just unimpressed. It was like a circus that was put together with duct tape. And the only shiny part was just what the audience was allowed to see. And it was, at first, it was demoralizing, I guess I would say. But I also noticed that opening bands were sometimes set up to fail. As one example, I had a friend in the Marine Corps. Every time he came to town, he always took me to a concert. And by chance, that concert always ended up being Rush because he loved Rush. We went to see Rush. And I think if I remember correctly, it was Matchbox 20 had just broke or was about to. But here's the funny thing. Total setup for failure. Everyone's seen Rush's stage. Massive. Well, what they'd done is they put the curtain down in front of Rush's setup, and there were like these garage amps set up at the very end of the stage for Matchbox 20 to play. And when they played, it was just the most, it was like watching a garage band. And I saw this time and time again, and I wondered if the headlining band was purposefully making them a lot less or whether it was something else. I mean, have you ever seen what I'm talking about here?
Yeah, I have. We've been victims of it many, many times. You tend to find that the support acts, however many there are, even the main support act, they tend to only get 2/3 of the volume that the main act gets. So that's the first imposition. You get a definitely reduced audio output from the PA, which always makes the main band look great. That's just basic mathematics. But then the other thing is you get a severely restricted light show and stage time is cut down 45 minutes maximum usually. So there's all these things. And then, you get the stage cordoned off. So you've got to set up in front of the guys who are the main act. And your monitors aren't particularly brilliant. And the front of house engineer isn't the main sound engineer for the main band. It's some other guy, probably a junior learning the ropes, who doesn't know your sound, who doesn't know you're from Adam. So there's so many things that compromise what you do, which when you become the headline act, it transforms your live output just so dramatically. And it makes the whole thing work again. And you sort of remember why you're doing it at that point. But yeah, I mean, this, of course, it's just basic business to make the headline act look better than everybody else.
You know, it's a funny thing. I did a show at San Diego State University at their open air amphitheater. I don't remember all the bands. I think it was, what was the other all-girl band that got so big in the 80s called? The Go-Go's. Okay, so the Go-Go's were there. Red Rider was there. I don't remember anyone, but one of the things you notice being a roadie is a lot of these bands that you thought were so talented, not so much, but then occasionally you see people that definitely are. As an example, on the show I just mentioned, the Go-Go's sounded very close to the Go-Go's, and the other bands like Red Rider, they just didn't pull it off so well. One time at that same venue, Pat Benatar was with Def Leppard. And they were walking. Def Leppard was like a character of itself. It was the later 90s, yeah. And it was just kind of pathetic. But Pat Benatar did her sound check. She did part of it without a microphone. And when you hear that voice, it's like, wow, that really is a unique individual. There's something going on there very few people could do. And then the headlining band, Def Leppard, not so much. It was like a pale echo of itself, to be fair. It was many years on into their run, though.
Yeah. The band that I really hoped you were going to say then when you said that, oh, the other girl band is one of my favorite bands ever. You may remember them. They were called Fanny.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God. What a band.
Do you remember what label they were on?
I don't. I've got all their albums as well, but I don't have access to them right now. But, oh, just check those girls out. They're just incredible.
Why did they never break? I mean, it's like that other, there was another act, I think, on Zeppelin's label, Maggie Bell or something like that, that never broke.
Yeah, shelving. It can only be shelving because their songs were head and shoulders above most of the bands. They're just stunning, stunning band.
Jason recently saw Oasis again.
Yeah.
Do you notice a big difference, Jason, between maybe a concert in the late 90s compared to what you just saw?
As far as specifically Oasis, this is the first time I'd ever seen them, but of course I've watched concert clips. The thing I'm noticing big time these days, even in medium venues, now Oasis was playing a giant stadium, so like 80,000, 100,000 people or whatever it was. It's the big difference with the digital boards that they use nowadays, which I dealt with a lot when I worked at Guitar Center, and the line array systems. Everything just sounds so much better these days. The funny thing about that is, if you're not good, it's also going to reveal that.
Yeah. And then there's the new, relatively new thing where most of the biggest bands now work with stems. Do you know what stems are?
Yeah. Yep. It's the individual track. It's the songs that you're familiar with pulled apart into individual. So the guitar or the violin is by itself.
Yeah, it's basically the Logic file running in the background and they play to that. So if anybody's having a bad day, the audience still get the result and the guy can have a bad day and have his fader dropped so nobody hears what he's actually doing live. And it's just cheating, every level cheating.
Playing a tape and miming to it in old school vernacular.
And too many big bands, usually older bands, have gotten caught doing that stuff. And it's not okay. If you're paying $300 a ticket, you damn well better be playing your instruments, man. Come on.
Case in point, you could buy the whole album for much less than you've paid to be there. And, you know, look at a band. Well, look at Rush again. Geddy Lee hasn't been able to hit those high notes, which were damn high when he was in his prime, for years. But he still goes out and does it, and people love him for it.
Yeah. It's just a different game nowadays. Although I will say, when you mentioned Def Leppard, when you hear those guys singing the backing vocals, the harmonies, you cannot get a piece of paper between them. They are so tight. And that's live. That's done live.
You know, that's got to be an experience too, because you're getting it through the monitors and the amps. So the resonance that forms when you're right in there, it's got to be quite an experience standing on the stage doing it.
I'll bet. Yeah. That's why they're all deaf.
Well, it's also why a lot of people switched over to in-ears over the last couple of decades.
Yeah, I cannot actually play a game now without in-ears.
I notice that they're very, very common these days. There's still some people who like the old school wedges, but with in-ears, you can tailor it so much, again, because of these digital boards. You can have personalized headphone mixes and all that.
The last band that I was in with my ex-wife, we got it to such a level where we've got a digital board with Wi-Fi connection, and we can download the app on our phones, and we can tailor our own monitor mix individually. We can do it on the fly. It's just unbelievable now. And again, if we had that 30 years ago when I was in my prime, it would have changed the game entirely.
Yeah, you could do all that cool stuff with the Personas gear that I'm familiar with.
I mean, at this point, I think even the general audience is starting to catch on to what's become of live shows. You see endless clips on YouTube now where they're saying they're doing black magic on the stage. There's been cases where the audience has gotten sick, passed out. I even think there's been cases where people have passed away recently. But when you look at what's going on the stage now with some of the modern current acts, it is night and day from what I remember when I was in my 20s going to a show. Very, very different experience. I mean, what do you guys think?
All of that started with the Beatles. There's been guys from some of the Beatles gigs, the big ones like Shea Stadium and things like that. They were working security and they've said that they had sort of rivers of urine running out of the audience where the girls were just losing control. If that's not a psyop, what is?
I saw on the Wayback Machine archive years ago, I found a paper. I wish I would have downloaded it. And it was making the claim that a test run for what became Beatlesmania was done in the Elvis era. And it was done with frequency that was actually broadcast through the PA because they knew that they could drive the audience into a frenzy. And it's the only time I've ever seen this idea expressed or claimed.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't see it at that level, but we saw it with the choice of our entry music. We always had a song, and ours was Thunderbirds. And then we switched it to something else. But we went through a few. We had a few different ideas. And it was the audience that informed us which was the right walk-on tune, because the reaction from them when we started up from the walk-on tune, it varied wildly depending on which one we used. And again, it can only be frequency.
It's such a difficult thing to talk about because, like the 440, 432 thing, the amount of pushback and just people refusing to even consider that there's something there overlooks the fact that everything is vibration.
Yeah.
One of the primary hermetic laws being nothing is stationary. And when you begin to realize that color and everything that we experience can be broken down to a vibration, you've got to imagine that people with a certain level of knowledge are easily going to be able to skew music or even film or anything with the idea of frequency in a certain direction.
Which kind of alludes to it only got better with the increasing level of technology. They only got better at doing it.
Right. Jason, can you talk about the 808, which is starting to be pretty well documented, a vibratory level that's basically aimed at the root chakra, where you might find violence and sex. Can you mention something about that, Jason?
The 808 that you're referencing is a kick drum sound on one of the old school analog drum machines. It's very deep, and it hits in a way that is very pleasing to people who make certain kinds of music. And a lot of people don't necessarily use the analog devices anymore, although some do, and there are reproductions. They use samples of it, but the frequency is still the frequency. So if there was some sort of intent originally in there, it would presumably still be there even on samples. And who likes to use the 808 sound a lot? Rap and hip hop.
The entire rap movement was built on the 808.
There's your intention right there. The foundational floor is a low-minded vibration. But I've got to ask you guys, you're both music guys, you both do the editing. If you open up modern softwares that you would use to try to cut an album or something, which many people do on their own now, is there an easy and obvious way to change the 440, 432 option of how you lay down your tracks in most softwares now?
Can't do it now.
It depends upon which piece of software you're talking about.
Well, I've tried many times on Logic, because that's what I use all the time now. And if anybody knows how to do it, I would be very interested to know. But so far, I've not found it.
Jason?
If you're talking about the virtual instruments and things like that, most of the time, there is a tune function. Some of them you can change semitones and even cents. And you would want to do minus 32 cents to get it to be around 432 hertz tuning. Or a lot of instruments actually have a literal tuner where you can take it and it'll change the sample to the pitch. And a lot of these things, you actually do need that, because for a lot of older classical pieces, they aren't necessarily, if they're being played authentically, going to have been in 440. So you actually need that. Like 421's a common one
with a lot of older pieces of music.
What about the intent? That's what comes to mind. You know, think of Dr. Emoto's work proving point blank that intention can be embedded in water. When I consider albums like Sgt. Pepper's, I consider that there's intent that has been embedded in that. So if I was to take something like Sgt. Pepper's and put it in a tool to crank it down to 432, what is actually being done to the music? And I would point out, it does nothing to the intent.
Well, I mean, if you're changing the resonant frequency of the machine that's capturing everything, then yeah, you're preserving whatever intent you want to put into it. It doesn't matter what your tuning is at that point, because the whole thing is running at that frequency.
What if you shift it after the fact, though? What if I have Sgt. Pepper's in 440 and I purposefully take the whole thing, like one JPEG, and I crank it down to 432? What have I actually done to the signal?
The waveform coming out is obviously altered. But if you're talking about an intent from the get-go, I don't see why that would change.
Now, here's the thing. I think if you're recording things in 432 from the get-go, all your layering and all that, like I do, then it's going to sound different, especially compared to just taking something that was already recorded in, say, 440, and then retuning it 8 cents lower from 440 to 432.
So to me, that's a double benefit, because your intention went with it, from my personal point of view. And if someone later came along and changed your floor frequency to something else, they could, but they can't take your intention out of it. That's the way I view it. I mean, how do you feel about that statement, Paul?
I think you're pretty on point there, but whatever your intention was, once it's been manipulated, I think it would be diluted. I don't think it would retain its original power, shall we say. I've done it. I've re-rendered several albums down to 432, and it changes them hugely. But I don't think it can affect the intent of the recording, because it's the clock speed of the machine that you're changing. So if you can tune your guitar to 432 or your piano or whatever, but if your clock speed of the machine that's recording it is still set at 440, I think you've diluted things. You've got to set everything to 432. And it's the clock speed of the machine that I don't think you can change anymore.
Well, I mean, now this can of worms you're laying on the table brings my mind to one place. You get an acoustic guitar, an open mic plugged straight into an amp that you're going to record from a live mic. What is the effect of the intent of that player of that song being recorded in that analog method when you change it to digital? So now there is no open air anything. It's being wired straight out of the guitar, straight into the recording device. It's being captured digitally. There must be a difference in how the intent is translated.
Yeah. The best explanation I've come up with for that is it's the difference between valves and solid state. So you can use the valve amps and get the beautiful tones, all the rest of it. But the minute you capture it on solid state equipment, I think it misses. It's like an old cassette. You lose the top end and you lose the bottom end. And what you're left with is a really strong middle, the mid range. Then you go to CD and all the top comes back and all the bottom comes back in. And I think that's what's happening when you go from sort of valve amps and the valve technology, which is warm and living almost, and then you capture it on solid state. I mean, it captures it pristinely, but I think you're losing the
authenticity,
the spiritual aspect of
right.
it, the heart of it. I think that's not captured.
This simile wraps up what you just said as we come to the top of the hour. It's the same as having a book with a classic story or a web page with the same classic story. The web page is a metaphor, literally a metaphor for what the book used to be. But there's something of the authenticity, in my view, in my experience, when you get into the digital representation. But guys, when we come back, I want to open up with this idea. We mentioned at the outset that there are the most famous players in the world on the stage that never played a musical instrument, can't read, never had music theory, don't know what makes a chord, none of it, but they are the most famous musicians in the world. What would our world be like if you had someone like Rick Beato as an example, who basically appears to be a musical savant, literally, the abilities that I have seen him talk about, if you had someone like that as the producer of music, how much would our world be different than what we currently see? But Paul, why don't you go ahead and tell folks where they can find you online?
Nowadays, it's not music related so much. It's my books that are all available on Amazon. And my pen name is P. Michael Yates. And it's very boring stuff like how to get out of debt without paying it, all things like that. And the most recent book is The Great Brain Robbery, which we covered in the previous interview. That's also on Amazon. I've got a big Facebook group, private group called Debt Ninjas. And then I've just written 7 books, short books, 250 pages each, which is The Trivium and The Quadrivium, which is all about opening your mind to its fullest potential.
In my view, The Trivium and The Quadrivium is what we're headed. We're going back to the future. These ideas, alchemical or natural science, these will be the things that emerge again in the new era. Jason, anything you want to add before I wrap up hour one?
Well, also in hour two, Paul, if you have anything we can delve into, since you did the thing that most musicians never get to, which is be on a big label where money is behind it, and you see that business, that industry from the inside, I'd love to hear anything you could possibly reveal that a lot of folks wouldn't know about that you'd be like, wow, that goes on?
Yeah, that'll be an interesting discussion. So let me wrap up real quick so we can take a break, come back for hour two. This has been hour one of episode 655 with Jason Lindgren and Paul Yates. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members of Crow 777 Radio get exclusive access to my current solar telescope work. There are also stills that people have requested. Many of them print huge, like 30, 40, 50 inches. Also, you get exclusive access to the film Shoot the Moon, has 10 awards in the world. It includes all the lunar waves that I shot, plus a couple, endless litany of what I'll just call UFOs, and the discovery of the so-called second sun in 2015. With that, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back for hour two. I hope to see you logged in as a member, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. Oh, there's one more thing. New members to crow777radio.com get to select a free solar image that they can print, and you should take a look. They're gorgeous. There it is, man. We'll be back shortly. Cheers. We'll be right back.
is the enemy of knowing.